It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to a reporter in Missouri about the protests happening there over the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager. Well, with September right around the corner, college students are starting their return to campus, and with that comes another year of college sports. And when football kicks off in a few weeks, the action on the field probably won't look any different than usual, but behind the scenes, it could be a whole new ballgame. Because of new reforms in the NCAA's largest conferences and a recent ruling by a federal judge, college athletes could be on their way to receiving additional benefits, including potential financial compensation from the licensing of athletes' names, images, and likenesses. Joining us now to talk about what's brewing in college sports is Welch Suggs. He's an associate professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. He's a former sports journalist and was the senior editor for athletics at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welch, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So in the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of news regarding the NCAA, and it sounds like you've been covering this beat for a long time. How big is this shakeup for the NCAA?
Well, you know, that's actually sort of a double-edged question. I would say, yes, this is the biggest pair of setbacks that the NCAA has had going back 40 years, actually, to a decision in 1984 that broke the NCAA's monopoly over college football on television. But at the same time, it's sort of amazing to see how powerful an institution college sports is, particularly if this is not something you follow every day. But the NCAA has been around since 1906, and the idea of amateur college sports, that is, athletes who play for their institution and not for pay, has been around that long and has been amazingly durable. And we still really don't know what the final outcome of either the O'Bannon decision or the NCAA's rules change on autonomy, to which you referenced, are going to be.
All right, well, let's talk about those two so we know what we're talking about here. In terms of athletes profiting from the licensing of their names, images, and likenesses, what do we know there?
Mm-hmm. So this is what's called the O'Bannon case. It refers to Ed O'Bannon, who is a star basketball player for UCLA going back almost 20 years. I think he's almost as old as I am. But he noticed his image and likeness being used in the EA Sports NCAA basketball video game, which may not sound like much, but he saw that his image was being used. He never received any pay for that and got to thinking about whether this was fair. He, along with a group of other plaintiffs and some very powerful antitrust attorneys, sued the NCAA, saying that their names, images, and likenesses, as the legal term is, should not be used without their permission, without compensation. And I guess it's almost 2 weeks ago now, Judge Claudia Wilkin in the Northern District of California ruled that they were right, that the NCAA could achieve all of the noble ideals it says come from hosting and promoting amateur sport without cutting off star players completely from compensation. So, as I said, no one knows exactly what this means, but it could mean that we see trust funds or something like that set up so that star athletes at places like Wisconsin-Madison could eventually benefit from jersey sales and the other uses of their names and images and likenesses while they're in college.
Why does this fall under the antitrust jurisdiction?
Because the NCAA is a collection of universities. There's over 1,000 of them and about 300 at the highest level in Division I, including Madison, as I mentioned, Marquette, University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And the NCAA sets rules for how athletics are governed. Now, those rules are limited. As I said, the courts have found before that the NCAA does have the power to enforce national rules that govern all of college sports and the conduct of college sports, but not necessarily business deals. So that creates kind of a gray area in between the rules on the field, like how many yards you have to go to get a first down, and the business practices of college sports. And as you're probably aware, college sports has become a very big business. The number thrown around is about $16 billion a year in total revenue to the NCAA and its member institutions. So the stakes have never been higher, and this creates a lot of questions about whether athletes ought to share in the tremendous groundswell of revenue that's come in recent years.
Well, and you mentioned another setback, and earlier this month, the NCAA's Division I Board of Directors approved a plan to give the five most prominent athletic leagues the autonomy to provide extra benefits to their athletes. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Sure, and it's, I don't know that setback is quite the right word to use, but it's an interesting development in the history of college sports. The NCAA has traditionally tried to maintain a level playing field in its rules, especially around recruiting and the treatment of student athletes and the benefits that are provided for them, so that, in theory, an athlete would choose among a number of different institutions, a number of colleges and universities, based on the best fit academically, personally, socially. You know, the kind of decision I'm sure that you made when you went to college and the kind of decision I made when I went to college. But that has always been a bit hypocritical, because if you were an athlete with aspirations of playing in the pros, then you're going to make your decision largely on the basis of the school you think most likely to get you there or the best deal that you can get. So an athlete who wants to go to the NFL obviously is going to be much more likely to choose Wisconsin-Madison if he earns a scholarship there, as opposed to, I would say, Drake University. You know, no offense to Drake, but it's just not quite the football powerhouse. So what the NCAA's rules mean is that conferences are now allowed to change things up and unlevel the playing field even more than they already are, so that if the top institutions, like those in the Big Ten Conference, want to award scholarships that cover up to the cost of attendance or provide stipends or to provide more food to recruits or allow them to participate in separate academic programs that previously would be considered extra benefits. So I know Commissioner Delaney of the Big Ten has mentioned study abroad, but providing other opportunities to athletes, when a lot of those are available to lower-tier schools, schools that don't have the money of a place like Madison. But previously rules have forbidden the top schools from taking advantage of the resources that they have, at least openly. So this really creates more of a divide between the haves and the have-nots, and the haves being the Big Ten, the SEC, the Atlantic Coast Conference, the Pac-12 Conference, and the Big 12 Conference, excuse me.
Now, where did that ruling come from? What was the legal basis for it?
That wasn't a ruling. That was merely a rules change by the NCAA's Division I Board of Directors. And all it really says is that the different conferences have the autonomy to make their own rules as regards recruiting and benefits and other provisions for athletes. So there's not a law being challenged in this case. It's merely a rule internally with the NCAA.
Gotcha. So how does this change, do you think, the recruiting processes going forward? You know, if you're Drake University, how are you supposed to stay competitive?
Well, it sort of begs the question of whether Drake was ever competitive with the Big Ten Conference schools, for example, or the Mid-American Conference schools is probably the better example of places like Central Michigan or Western Michigan or Eastern Michigan. How are they supposed to compete with Ann Arbor for recruits? Well, it does make it even that much harder, and it makes it that much less likely that athletes with NFL potential are likely to go to those schools. So really what it does, Veronica, I think most of all, is just lay bare the differences between these kinds of schools in ways that have been avoided in the past.
Not only that, but does it preference particular sports, college football and basketball, for example?
Well, that's the biggest fear, of course, is that this is going to create even more of an arms race in those sports to recruit the best athletes, especially for the schools within the Big Five conferences that don't make as much money as the others. Think of Indiana or Purdue as compared to Wisconsin or Michigan or Ohio State. Or down where I am, think of Mississippi State or Vanderbilt compared to Alabama or Georgia or Florida. And the concern there is that especially for schools with very large sports programs, and the Big Ten has historically had much broader sports programs. You have lacrosse, you have soccer, you have field hockey, you have synchronized swimming at some schools, that the cost pressures in the big-time sports to provide adequate packages to those athletes could result in fewer opportunities for athletes in non-revenue sports, and especially for female athletes. That's one of the big concerns, is that the progress that's been made under Title IX could stall out as a result of this ruling.
Could stall out. Could we also see potential lawsuits there?
It's possible. Moving back to the O'Bannon case for a second, that's been one of the really interesting questions of what Title IX basically says is that colleges have to provide comparable opportunities at the same level of competition. So, in theory, if you are going to have a football team where every athlete gets a $2,000 stipend and recruits, you know, stay at four-star hotels and this and that, then you ought to have a female sport that's privileged comparable to that. But that remains to be seen. Is that really going to happen? And if it doesn't happen, could that lead to more lawsuits? Now, Title IX, I mean, progress for women's sports, and this is, you know, totally beyond the scope of what you called ask about, has stagnated over the past decade or so for unrelated reasons. And so this seems like it could raise another set of fairness issues for female athletes.
We're talking now with Welch Suggs about the possible changes in the works for college sports. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Should college athletes be eligible for a piece of the NCAA's profits when their image is used? Maybe there's a video game character with their jersey number. Should they get some money for that? Seems like we're heading that way. And do you think paying players undermines the educational nature of college sports? Do you think this is the time to redefine college sports? And if so, what should they look like? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the future of the NCAA with Welch Suggs, professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Should college athletes be entitled to a piece of the NCAA's profits, or is the system currently in place working, do you think? And what other reforms might you like to see in college sports? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Welch, how do you think this affects the relationship between higher education and its goals of preparing students for a future career in the world and the goals of athletics?
Well, that's really the crux of it, and you got to that in a little bit with your lead out from the last segment, is what is a fair deal for college athletes and how should college sports work in the modern world of higher education? And, you know, the United States is unique in the world of doing a lot of its elite athlete development through its educational system. You know, if you go to the Europe or to Asia or Africa or South America, there's no other nation that tries to prepare elite athletes through their high schools and their universities. And it's been a very weird marriage for a very long time. And I think it's a historical marvel that it's persisted in the way it has. But what's really under threat now is this idea that college athletes ought to be unpaid amateurs playing for the love of the game. If you look through the NCAA's literature, if you look through the policies of college sports, they're all designed that way. But it's never really been that way. There have been athletes who have used colleges and used high schools even as training grounds for the pros since time immemorial. And is that such a bad thing? You know, we've invested a lot of infrastructure in making it happen that way. And whenever issues like this come up, you see a lot of ideas. You see people suggesting that maybe we ought to allow students to major in athletics, to major in sport preparation. Or you see other people on the other side who say that colleges ought to divorce athletics altogether or adopt something like a Division III model where there are no scholarships, many fewer opportunities, and much less pressure. And there are other models all around the world. You know, most nations have clubs that develop elite athletes, whether it's for sports like soccer or basketball, where kids will turn pro, you know, as early as 10 or 12 or 13 in some cases.
And do those kids generally end up going to school and getting college degrees?
Well, some do. You know, much few. I don't have stats in front of me. You'd have to look at UNESCO or something like that. But no, many fewer of them actually participate in higher education. But, you know, that's different. You know, we obviously have a different higher education system in this country where, you know, a lot more of our population is in the pipeline. But you know, I'll tell you one funny example. Back when I was at the Chronicle of Higher Education, our South African reporter did a story on the soccer team at the Wits University, the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, where the soccer team there actually played in the South African equivalent of Major League Soccer or the NFL. I mean, it was a professional team. Players got paid, and they could go on scholarships at the university if they wanted to. And the team's nickname was the Clever Boys. And I just thought that was an interesting allegory to say that, you know what, maybe there is nothing sacred about amateurism. Maybe we should allow athletes, you know, a chance to learn something about the world, but also prepare to play at the highest levels. And so there's all sorts of interesting things out there. And what will be very interesting is to see if colleges move in one of those directions to really divest from athletics because it either costs too much money, especially in the case of smaller schools, or because it doesn't work to have athletes who are obligated to be full-time students anymore. And so either of those is possible.
Yeah, the amateurism question is interesting. I want to come back to that. But first, let's take a call from Caleb in Lancaster. Hi, Caleb.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
I'm just curious because I do believe that if you bring money into the equation, that it's going to corrupt the system. It's going to corrupt the kids. It's going to change the way their views on college football. And I just think that it's not. It's going to hurt it. It's going to hinder the system. I don't see why, if the NCAA is making money off of these kids, why can't they take a portion of each sale, of each jersey sale or whatever it may be, and either donate it or send it right back to the program, or, you know, or set up scholarships for kids that, you know, that aren't available to make those payments and stuff like that for school. So.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Caleb. That's an interesting perspective there. Maybe the NCAA shouldn't be profiting so much, you know, never mind giving it back to the athletes. Maybe they should feed it back into the program, or there should be some different monetary model there. What do you think, Welch?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you look at the largest growth of in expenses in college sports, it's salaries and facilities. So what happens with all that money that schools generate, that conferences generate from their TV contracts, and that the NCAA generates, is it all goes into paying more money for coaches and building new facilities to try to entice recruits. So to the caller's point, money has always been part of it. Money has always been a dividing factor between what we call the haves and the have-nots, the schools that can actually sustain money and those that have to depend on their institutions to subsidize them to stay in business, essentially. And so it's an interesting idea, but, you know, who are you going to get that money from? Are you going to turn to the football and basketball coaches and say, okay, we're going to pay you $1.5 million, and we're going to put this other $500,000 here back into a university or into something else? So it's a great idea, but I think the money is already there, and the question is more how it should be allocated.
Now, getting back to that question of amateurism, does that mean that that argument is being sort of slowly but unforgivably chipped away at, and then it's not going to hold much water anymore, that fuzzy line between pro athletes and amateur athletes in college?
I think it has to a certain degree, but again, you know, I think what both of these decisions do is lay bare the situation that's always been there. You know, kids who are elite athletes, who are called 3-star, 4-star, 5-star recruits, are making decisions based on their sport. And even if they're not getting a paycheck, they're making decisions where they think they're going to get playing time, where they think they're going to be able to be stars and attract the notice of teams on draft day. And coaches are making the same decisions based on kids they think will help them win games and preserve their jobs and compete again for those higher paychecks. And then what's even more concerning from my standpoint is the way you see the practices in the high-profile sports like football and basketball kind of migrate to other sports, to Olympic sports and non-revenue sports. So you see them, if they can't recruit the talent in their own states to be competitive, they'll start recruiting internationally or in other places. Or they'll start demanding the same kinds of facilities or treatment that they see football and basketball coaches getting. And while no one's paying the tennis coach as much as they're paying the basketball coach, still, you see elements of that trickling down for the places that can afford it, and that puts even more pressure on the system. So I think this may sound really cynical, Veronica, but I just don't think amateurism has really been part of the equation for a very long time. Now, having said that, college athletes, you know, being a college athlete is a great experience, even with these pressures. I was a Division III athlete. I teach athletes every semester here at the University of Georgia. And they're good kids, and they work hard, and like the cliche goes, most of them are going pro in something other than sports. But they do recognize and they do see that college sports is a business, and both regular students and athletes see that. And so I think it's dangerous to assume that that is not otherwise the case.
We're going to leave it there. Welch, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me. I sure appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Welch Suggs, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Georgia. We've got a link to his piece, An Opportunity to Redefine College Sports, on the Central Time Facebook page.